TNT Radio wants to know what you really think, because your opinion matters. At TNTRadio.live, upload a video, some audio, or drop us a note on TNT Radio's Soapbox. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. This is the No Fly Zone with Greg Mayberry on today's news talk, TNT Radio.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the No Fly Zone here again on TNT Radio. Before we get into the nitty-gritty today, just a quick announcement. TNT Radio is actually streaming live the Rage Against the War Machine rally in Washington, D.C. at the Lincoln Memorial this Sunday. That's New York from 12:30 p.m., London from 5:30 p.m., and Brisbane 3:30 a.m., Monday, of course, Australian time. For more information, visit TNT Radio Live and rageagainstwar.com, or keep listening to TNT Radio for updates there. So, guys, time to rage against the war machine, which I've been doing for quite a while, along with plenty of other people, and it's something we obviously need to keep on doing. Well, welcome again, as I said, to another episode of the No Fly Zone here on TNT Radio. I'm now in the 6th month on air, I'm pleased to report, which is very pleasing. One of the aims, listeners, when I began this broadcast was similar to what I've always tried to do with my articles that I now publish on Substack mainly. And that's to bring to the fore a deeper appreciation of the realities of our past, but always within the context of events and developments unfolding in the here and now. It's my view that we simply just can't hope to gain any useful insights into news events that are now unfolding without that sort of deeper understanding. You know, you got to think about the war in Ukraine, think COVID and the pandemic, think the Nord Stream pipeline sabotage, any of the major news events and developments, a perspective on history in considering those news events, there's a lot to be said for it. But the thing is, what's always been surprising for me about this simple insight is that few establishment historians, whilst they might pay lip service to this imperative, actually practice it. Indeed, the study of history is littered with the bodies of many an historian who strayed from the path of the official accepted record of our past. And this is one reason why so few are prepared to challenge these official narratives. Now, one such man was Professor Anthony Sutton, who passed away in 2002, sadly. And I single out Professor Sutton here, not just because he was an exemplar of those scholars whose primary remit was discovering the reality of our past and not just simply preserving the mythology of it. And he also paid a heavy professional penalty for doing so, which was the fate of many a person who stepped outside the mainstream narratives. But our guest today is also someone who's personally well acquainted with Professor Sutton, as well as his immense body of work and his considerable and significant legacy. As an independent publisher, he has proactively supported many historians, writers, and researchers who are carrying on in the Anthony Sutton tradition. I'd like to welcome today Chris Milligan, who is the publisher of a small, highly respected independent book company based in Oregon. Chris launched Trine Day Publishers in response to the consistent refusal of the corporate press to publish many interesting, well-researched and well-written books with one key defect, as he defined it himself, which was a challenge to the official history that would tend to rock the boat of America's corporate and political culture. And the aforementioned Anthony Sutton was a master at doing that. Now, along with these publishing duties, Chris also hosts The Journey, which is an excellent podcast series available via the Trine Day website and all the usual podcast platforms. Chris Milligan, welcome to the No Fly Zone.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on, sir.
My pleasure. I've been looking forward to this for some time, Chris. I make no bones about the fact that I've been a long-time reader of Trine Day's publishing list and have been very impressed with the range of views and topics and the range of authors that you've had on your list. And so it is not only just a pleasure, it's a privilege and an honour to have somebody like yourself in the publishing business really sort of stand out from the pack and go out there and look for the kinds of information that I believe, and I'm sure you do as well, that people need to be aware about, as per my introduction, is that we are getting from independent publishers a much deeper perspective on that history. Chris, I'd like you to start off, just give us some background on yourself and how you came to be involved in the world of independent publishing, how you came to start Trine Day. What's the sort of history and background to yourself and how you became involved?
Well, basically, I'm an intelligence brat. My father was in intelligence, got involved in the 30s as an exchange student to China. Involved in a COI, coordinator of information, which turned into OSS. And while he was in OSS, he got drafted, and so OSS put him into G2, and so and then he was in CIA, and he left them, as he told me, soft in 57, left them hard in 59, and he started talking to me in 69. I didn't really understand what he had to say, but because of that, I started hanging out in a world I called CIA drugs. And the internet came along, and he had mentioned a thing about secret society, so I was looking at that, and it took me a long time to find out information about secret societies, and I like books. I read a lot, but I came across Anthony Sutton's America's Secret Establishment in 1988, and it made sense of some of the stuff that my dad had talked to me, and I started writing some stuff about Skull and Bones, and I put out some missives to publishers, and I got one back from Farrell House, and he, Adam Parfait, said, well, he didn't think that he was ready to take on Skull and Bones, and so that started me thinking about some things, and the internet was coming along. I was running some email lists, and one of them was CIA Drugs and had some people on there, and one of them was Daniel Hopsicker, and he was decrying that nobody was going to publish his book. It had been with an agent in New York for a couple of years. And I heard that a couple of times and finally said, well, I've got a computer on my desk. They tell me I can make a book. So I helped Daniel make Barry and the Boys. And then I had become friends with Anthony Sutton. He informed me that his book was going out of print, and I said, oh, Anthony, that can't happen. And I went out and borrowed $5,000 and started a publishing company, little knowing what I was doing.
So we've got Anthony Sutton to thank for Trine Day, then, is that correct?
Well, tangentially, yes.
It's interesting you mentioned Daniel Hopsicker. He is certainly one author. I read not the book that you mentioned, the Barry and the Boys. Was that about Barry Seal?
Yes.
Okay. Barry Seal, of course, there was a movie made about that, I think, with Tom Cruise in it. I can't remember the name of the film, but he, of course, was very heavily involved
it's a film story. That's not the true story.
No, I gathered that, he was very heavily involved for the purposes of explaining to listeners. Barry Seal was heavily involved in the Iran-Contra scandal and ferrying drugs backwards and forwards and ferrying arms backwards and forwards between the States and Nicaragua, if I recall. Was that right?
Well, that's part of his story. I mean, he started running guns to Castro early on. He started flying when he was a teenager. And yeah. Yes, he became a rather large drug smuggler because, you know, if there was two sugar companies, and there's not, there's just one sugar company. But if there was two sugar companies and you had one company bringing in cocaine and the other one not, you know, which one's going to last? You know, yeah. So there's a very good Australian professor, Carl Trackey, who wrote a book, Opium and the Political Economy, that goes into it very much chapter and verse and shows how the drug trade completely changes history because it gives people in the shadows a huge amount of money, which then Absolutely. Allows them to obfuscate and play games.
There have been quite a few books. That particular author, funnily enough, I'm an Australian. I've not been familiar with him, and I've just made a note here, and I will certainly follow him up later on. But yeah, no, I will check that out, Chris, and thanks for the heads up on that. But there have been many books written about the international drug trade, which you and I are familiar with, and people, in my view, just simply have no idea not only how huge it is in terms of, you know, the black economy, but just how much it fuels political corruption and crime at the international level and drug running and money laundering and a whole range of other illicit activities. And, you know, I mean, we've down here in Australia, we've got our own story to tell about that, that's for sure. But without sort of getting too far off track here, I find the story about how you got the company together, you obviously saw a gap in the market, really, let's call it what it is. You clearly, the mainstream press, so we often think of the mainstream press as being the print and electronic news media. But, of course, it incorporates much more than that. It incorporates, obviously, you know, book publishing. It incorporates Hollywood, incorporates the public relations business. There's a whole gamut of different facets of the publishing media business. And, of course, historical and political publishing, as in book publishing, is sort of like, you know, an area of its own. And that's essentially where Trinday has kind of positioned itself in wanting to sort of put out there the sorts of information that people like Anthony Sutton and various historians and writers and commentators were encountering, but couldn't find publishing, anybody interested in the mainstream publishing to publish the books. And you've managed to be, you know, very, very successful at that. But what is curious to me, or what is interesting for me, Chris, is in the print media and the electronic news media, there's a fairly sharp dichotomy, I guess, if you like, between what we would call the mainstream media and the alternative independent media. Do you see the same sort of dichotomy in the publishing business in terms of, you know, the mainstream publishing of books and the alternative publishing books? Is the same dynamic involved here? You know, like, for example, are the same political considerations there and the same commercial considerations there? Or are they different? Is there a different sort of a dynamic there?
Well, you know, I mean, the political consideration is just, you know, people have agendas, correct? Okay, yep. And my basic is you know, looking at the future. I mean, what is the what are these people in the shadows? What are they looking to do? You know, do they want to make more money? No, they basically have enough money. It's basically about control, and so you know, my basic agenda is I want to see a better world for our children. And so as far as a commercial viability, it's because of the personal computer and the internet, you know, from the changes that have happened, because the personal computer allows me to be a publisher. Without that, I couldn't be a publisher. Okay. And then the internet allows me to tell people about it. So, you know, and I haven't gone out and found people to write books. There's a dearth of books being thrown at people like me to do this. And, you know, it's not a it's not, publishing isn't an easy business, okay? The powers don't make it easy. They've actually, you know, tried to put me out of business plenty of times. I've had to go to federal district court to keep publishing a book. They wanted me to declare it fiction. And then they've played all kinds of mercantile games. But, you know, I'm just a stubborn SOB, and my mama is a very nice lady. Okay. But, you know, it's very few people actually read books. Okay. It's a small percentage. And where it really gets dicey, you might say, is when people try and make them into movies. Okay. Into that type of narrative. Because, like I said, very few people read books, but almost everybody, you know, goes to the movies or watches TV or, you know, the streaming, all of this stuff. So that's where I found the biggest resistance. Okay. I mean, they'd love for me just to stop, but, you know, and what they generally do is they just ignore us. Okay. Yeah. Because if they give any kind of a shrift to us, okay, then they've got to explain what they're doing. That's why you have, you know, all of this demagoguery going on out there, because it's much easier to overblow, okay, these conspiracy things, to get people into little camps, okay, so that they're throwing bombs at each other, okay, and so it's an interesting position of doing this, but like I say, I'm just it's mostly just because I'm stubborn that I'm still here. I mean, I was you know, I've been going deeper into debt mostly every year, okay, and but there is a you've got a lot of people who just use it to try and make money. I mean, I get calls from people all the time where, you know, they have somebody that's going to charge them $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $3,000, you know, $30,000 to publish their book and stuff. So we live in very interesting times, to say the least. You know, how old are you, Greg?
Chris, I'll come back to that in a moment. We've got to go for a quick break. Happy to answer that question when we come back. But we're speaking here with Chris Milligan from Trinde Publishers. We're going for a short break. We'll be back shortly.
TNT Radio's Alan Miller.
On the point of controversy and cancelling or censoring, or you're not allowed to say that, this week we've seen a lot of that in demands for people to go one way or another in attacks that have been made, calling people names, using the C word, calling everyone a conspiracist, rather than having a conversation or a discussion, rather than addressing why, for instance, in Sheffield, residents came out on the street and said, we're not going to have these barriers. And councillors recognising actually this is a problem, rather than saying we've got questions about, you know, the impacts to local businesses and families, and rather than addressing those things, some people, you know, in the press and elsewhere want to say these are all just conspiracies, and that's a big problem. And we think that, you know, certainly together we think that free speech is paramount, and on TNT Radio, free speech is vital and fundamental.
Alan Miller on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Laurie from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
90% of parents still say no thanks to COVID-19 shots for their young children. Lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to the No Fly Zone. I'm speaking today with Chris Milligan, who is the publisher of Trine Day Books in Oregon. And we're talking generally about publishing in a very different environment now than what it was 10, 15, 20 years ago, one that's much more heavily censorial and much more propagandized. Chris, I just want to go back to a point you, and I certainly don't want to be seen to be escaping that question you asked, how old I was, and I think I know where you might have been going with that. Look, I'm going to be upfront about that. I turned 70 last year. You mentioned a couple of things before about our kids and that sort of thing. I mean, I've got a family. I've got two grandchildren that I totally am devoted to. And, you know, the whole prospect of the future, as I see it now, and I came to a late epiphany. Turn 60 before I started to realize there was something radically wrong with the way the world was being run. I've got two kids. That really fuels my passion for what I'm doing at the moment. And, you know, I'm only just the small player that's out there doing it. But I feel like I've got to do something, a bit like you. I'm a stubborn bugger. You know, I really hate and resent bullies. I've got a very strong sense of injustice, or a strong sense of justice, depending on which way you look at it. It seems to me like, you know, that kind of fuels you as well, the sort of family thing, the thought about, you know, where you're, you know, what the future is going to hold for your family. I've reached a sort of an age where, again, like you too, Chris, the internet for me was crucial. I wouldn't even be sitting here and having this conversation with you had it not been for the internet and social media and all that sort of thing. And when I came to the realization of what was actually wrong with the world and started doing my own research, I was then able to sort of use whatever skills that I had to put my own views out there. And that sort of led me to where I am at the moment. So I guess in a sense, we've kind of gone on a not the same sort of journey, but a similar kind of a journey where our own passions and insights and understandings have led us to a certain point, but also to we've been we've been helped out there by the technology that's been available to us to be able to do that. So I guess I'm not sure if that's where you were going with that, and it might be a long-winded way of responding to it. But yeah, I'm of a certain age, and you know, I really fear for our future, but at the same time, I'm optimistic and hopeful, and I want to do whatever I can to create an awareness with people about what's happening in the world and go from there.
Well, there's, you know, the reason I asked the question, and I'm in my, I'm 73, soon to be 74, is that there's a very good book called America's Future, Cycle of Generations, Generations, A History of America's Future. Okay. And
not familiar with it, but
in this book, notes, they show how there's these different generations. There's an idealistic, and then there's a reactive, and then there's a civic, and then there's an adaptive generation that goes through history and helps propel us in the future. Okay. And one thing that this book shows is that the kids who were teens and preteens during the 1860s, they were the idealistic group. They didn't come together, okay, as a generation. Some of them joined the generation after. Some of them joined the generation before. Some of them just went out in the woods and did weird stuff, okay? and because of that, because, you see, all of us together, okay, on this blue ball, all of us together, you know, we have a fail-safe device, so we just don't run off the cliff, okay? And the first fail-safe device is something known as a dialectic, okay? Yep. And I find that the dialectic can be manipulated. I call it the dark hallway, okay? I say some stuff that I know are true about intelligence agencies, secret societies, and drug running. Okay. And then I find somebody who's a spook that says stuff just a little bit more outrageous. Okay. Because by controlling the extremes, you control the middle. Okay. So that fail-safe device can be manipulated. So the next fail-safe device we all have together is this cycle of generations. Okay. So when this idealistic group of the 1860s, the kids that were teens and preteens, they didn't cohere. And they didn't cohere because of the assassination of a president, war, yeah, and drugs. Okay. And because they didn't cohere, it made this four-cycle engine only running on three cycles and became more easily to manipulate that from outside influences, okay? And so they ended up, the civics generation, when they came about, they didn't have the footing to stand on, okay? Yeah. And so America went to empire, and a lot of this had to do with drugs, okay? Because, yeah, of the Philippines, and I mean, it's quite a long story. But they tried to do this again to the kids that were the teens and preteens in the 1960s. Okay. Yes. And we said, hey, well, wait a minute, there's war going on. There's the president's been killed, and now there's all these drugs going around.
Yeah.
And so basically, we jumped aside and created a counterculture. Okay. Basically, and the generation did come together. Okay, as hippies around a joint being smoked around a circle with a little bit of LSD thrown in, because the basic drug that they used before was opium and heroin. And, you know, the dynamic of heroin is, well, here, kid, you want some? Oh, you'd like some more?
Yeah.
Well, how about your friends? Okay. Yeah. And, you know, it was, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, I mean, it would be very interesting. Marijuana would be around. Then all of a sudden, all the marijuana would go away and there'd be all these white drugs into the scene. Okay. And the History Channel did a big 2-hour special on the hippies, and they said, what came out of the hippies? They said, well, the personal computer and the internet. So you said, these are the tools that we are all using to fight the corruption of people using secrecy to lie, cheat, and steal.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, one thing that I was able to do, because see, my daddy, he started talking to me in 1969. Okay. So I go out and I talk to my friends and say, hey, well, this is, you know, I'm looking into this, and my daddy told me this, and somebody looked at me in the early 70s and told me, well, you're a conspiracy theorist. Okay. I've been hanging out in conspiracy theory land for over 50 years.
Yeah.
Okay. And I've watched the conspiracy theory bus come by over and over and over again, okay, to get people in on this conspiracy, on that conspiracy, because one of the first things I learned is that a conspiracy theory doesn't have to be true to have an effect.
Yeah.
Okay. And just as much as the mainstream poo-poos conspiracy theories, okay, a conspiracy theory is used to, again, deflect and divide our population all the time, and push us into little things. And then by looking at this for a long time, I was able to deduce that, you know, here's how, because it's you know, people like to, oh, well, it's all the CIA's fault, it's all these people's fault. And what I've come to see is that it's a thing called the what I call the secret societal network. Okay.
Yes.
That is able to, like in the Kennedy assassination, is able to go through and into different various things, and you know, the CIA, the Secret Service, other places, and use and abuse those. Okay. And how the secret societies, quote unquote, run the world is a leviathan of three levels, and each level has three parts. And the top level is mining, metal, and money. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, you think about it, and it kind of makes sense that if you control the mining, where the metal comes from, that the money's based on, you're in a pretty good position, right?
Yeah.
And so, and I had an author that could affect that thing, and I resisted his book for a while, and actually didn't print one, but then printed this one, and he was dead within 7 days, run over by a hit-and-run lorry in London, okay? And this wasn't a, you know, he was a substantial guy. His lawyer was Bill Pepper of...
William Pepper, yep.
And who represented the King family.
That's okay? Correct, yes. I've written about him.
Then where this... the middle level is a very active level, okay? They use war a lot, but it's drugs, guns, and oil, okay? Yeah. And then oil also includes the pharmaceutical companies,
yeah,
okay?
Exactly, which a lot of people don't realize.
And where this meets the road is media, okay? Because they've got to control the media, right?
Yes.
And then you've got movies/music, because they've got to control the culture or it'll come back and bite them, okay? And then it's quote-unquote magic, okay? Their ability to hoodwink us and their preponderance on using mass trauma to keep us in line, like the Kennedy assassination and 9/11 and things such as that.
I'd also throw in there, Chris, to education. I mean, I have a teaching background, and for me, the education system that we've been governed by now in the West for years and years is a very integral part of that whole construct, you know, of creation of, you know, perception
right.
of our reality.
Right. That was one of the first things that, like, when you look at Skull and Bones, as far as in the United States, that was one of the first things that they did was to take over the education system, and they basically brought over the Prussian education system, where the Prussians got very mad at their people because Napoleon kicked their butt, excuse the language, and they, you know, that's where compulsory education started, and they actually, you know, took kids by bayonet point and started teaching them, you know, what to think instead of how to think.
It wasn't so much education, it was indoctrination. That was really what it was all about.
Yeah. Right, right. And this was a system that these guys brought over here to the United States and also helped develop and put around the world. Now, I've got this book called School World Order. School World Order. A gentleman looked a lot into Skull and Bones also. John Taylor Gatto.
I know John Taylor Gatto. Yes, he written some tremendous stuff on the Western education system. I've read about four of his books, and I was tremendously influenced by his views on the system itself. And anybody that wants to understand how Western education works, I could recommend no better author. John Taylor Gatto.
Yeah, he was working with Anthony when.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Anthony Sutton.
When Anthony passed away, because you know, Anthony was quite a window into this world, okay? Because like when he first started writing about Skull and Bones, I mean, you know, we've got this letter in fleshing out Skull and Bones that, you know, from George H.W. Bush says, oh, he wasn't a member of any sordid secret society. These things didn't exist, you know, because Anthony, you know, he was a Brit, and he came over here to the United States and met a gal and got married and became a naturalized citizen and was working at the Hoover Institute. Yeah. And they had contracted him to write this series of books called the how Western technology had affected the Soviet technology.
Yep.
And he got to the point where he was ready to publish the third volume, and they said, well, Anthony, we aren't going to publish that right now. and he didn't quite go along with that agreement and went around and published it himself as National Suicide, and they came to him and said, "Now, Anthony, don't break your rice bowl." And the reason was because the Vietnam War was being prosecuted, you know, was happening, and the Chinese weren't behind the Vietnamese in that war. It was the Russians. And the Chinese didn't like it so much that they wouldn't even allow the Russians to do trains across China carrying the war material.
Yeah.
And he showed in his book how this war material was coming from factories that had been, a bunch of them been ordered through Italy and set up in Russia. And were, you know, some of them even had American engineers. But a bunch of the war material that was being used to prosecute the Vietnam War was becoming from factories in Russia that had been, you know, kind of colluded in there so that they would have enough things so the war could happen. Because what my daddy told me, you know, the first things out of his mouth, he took me in this room with this professor from Vanderbilt, Dr. D.F. Fleming, and looked at me and he said, "The Vietnam War is about drugs. There's these secret societies behind it."
Yeah.
I'm thinking, hey, Dad's talking about the mafia. And then he says, "And communism's all a sham. These same secret societies are behind it all. It's all a big game."
Yes, absolutely.
And he, you know, he that didn't compute, so he starts to lose me, you know. And then then they start talking to me all about my dad's intelligence career. And then they get into the Vietnam War and they say, they tell me that they're playing out a lose scenario in Vietnam. And you know, this was day before my 20th birthday, so you know, they were looking to draft me and Australian boys and other boys and girls out there to go to the war. And I was saying, well, wait a minute, they're saying I've got to go kill people, but there's rules how to kill them. And then I got my dad and this professor telling me that, quote unquote, they are playing out a lose scenario. I mean, you play out a loose scenario in war. I mean, that doesn't make any sense to a 19-year-old kid, you know?
Chris, we've got to go to a quick break. I'm loving what I'm hearing you talk about, because obviously I had sort of I was a little bit younger than you at the same time, but was faced with the prospect of being drafted over here in Vietnam, and I know quite a bit about the sort of history of this, but I'd want to come back to sort of Anthony Sutton after the break. Listeners, we have with us today on the No Fly Zone, Chris Milligan from Trinday Publishers. We're going to go for a short break. We'll be back very soon.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
An El Nino is coming on. Traditionally, when these El Ninos do occur, we really dry it out across much of Australia. Now, of course, we've had a lot of wet weather in the east over the past year or so with this La Nina. And that wet weather is going to lead to more than normal amounts of vegetation. We see the same kind of phenomena in California. And of course, the left loves to jump all over wildfires. They live in a wildfire dream world, as if wildfires aren't supposed to happen. The interesting thing is the natural, key word natural, not man-made, natural back and forth of the weather leads to wet times that leads to more vegetation, and then the dry times show up and the vegetation dries out. So what does that mean as far as wildfires? Again, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure it out. So if you start hearing a lot about wildfires in California and Australia this upcoming season, you'll know the reason. This is TNT Climate and Weather Watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
You have the right to know. The right to know about culture. The right to know about the economy. The right to know about technology and to know about sports. You have the right to know about education and politics and the weather. You have the right to know what's happening abroad and in your backyard. But above all else, you have the right to know that this right is under attack, and we must work to protect it. Because in order to be free, we must be informed. Understand the threats. ProtectPressFreedom.org.
When government efficiency is about as good as the smell of a rest area bathroom,
quite frankly, it stinks.
You need today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Listeners, welcome back to the No-Fly Zone. I'm Greg Mabry. I have with me as my guest today Mr. Chris Milligan, who is the principal and founder of Trinday Publishers in the US. Chris, we were talking about, I guess indirectly, Anthony Sutton, but his reporting on the relationship between the West and the Soviet Union, and we got onto, you know, the Vietnam War, what the Vietnam War was all about. A lot of it had to do with drugs, and you know, had a lot to do with much of what we were not told in our history books and all of that sort of thing. And I know this because I, for a time, I was a history teacher, and I know that what we were teaching our kids was a long way from what I discovered much later was the reality of the situation. And when I did make those discoveries, certainly Anthony Sutton, who we are talking about here and at various points in our conversation, Anthony Sutton's books, and I think it was the Wall Street series that really brought home to me just exactly what goes on behind the scenes, you know, how wars happen, how depressions happen, and how, in fact, with the collusion between the West and the rise of the Nazis, and the collusion between the West and, if you like, the rise of the Bolsheviks and the Cold War and all of that sort of thing, you know, our understanding of those developments and events in 20th century history have you know, Anthony Sutton turned my understanding of it all on its head. Do you think that's more or less really, do you think that's the sort of an effect that he had with his work? Was I unusual there in responding that way to what people like Anthony Sutton had to say about the real history, the hidden history of our past?
No, it's an effect that it's happened to a lot of people. No, he, you know, tore away the curtain, as you might say. But yeah, he wrote the Wall Street books because he wanted to see, you know, something was affecting his career, okay? And so he was just, you know, trying to look back at history and different things and see how come it was happening to him. And then a lady in Maine sent him copies of the Skull and Bones membership list.
That's correct. I remember the story, yeah.
And he looked at those and said, here's some of the people that I've been writing about. And so then he put together his, he put together these pamphlets about the order and how it controlled education, how it controlled war and revolution and a couple others. And he wasn't able to find a publisher here in the United States, so he actually started getting these pamphlets published in Australia. And they started to get stole off the docks. And he, at that point in time, this was in the 60s and 70s and early 80s, and he you didn't have the internet, and what you had was these newsletters, and he was producing a newsletter, and one of the people on the newsletter, a mom and pop print shop up in Montana, said, yeah. What do you mean you don't have a publisher? We'll print it for you. And so they printed it for him for many years, and you know, and he went through lots of changes. He remember him telling me one time, he said, I got tired of going to these, you know, rubber chicken dinners, and I'd be sitting there, you know, on one side would be a Bircher and on the other side would be a UFO person. And he got tired of that and just, kind of went back to his first love, which was technology.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he was basically, you know, I've got his, one of his doctoral theses, and he was a engineer, one that would look at things from all the way from the raw material, say, to a finished plane, and all the things that the raw material and all the, like an airplane factory, all the different materials that it would have to get together to, you know, make the airplane. So
he brought, in that sense, he brought a really fascinating and unique perspective on looking at history, really. I mean, you know, how many engineers come at history and are able to write as eloquently and as, you know, and as accurately as he did about history and leave such an extraordinary legacy in the process as well, Chris, you know?
Right. Well, he had, you know, learned in academia the ability to go and find first source documents.
Yes.
And that was really one of his fortes, was be able to put that together. And now, you know, it's interesting. I've got a manuscript from a gentleman out of Brussels, and in it's based on a report from a Belgium state police report, where they put an informant into this secret societal network, and they rose up into it, and what they basically found was that there was a whole bunch of different groups all called the Order, and in them you had, like, you know, a Catholic one, a Jewish one, a gay one, a Muslim one, all these different groupings of people, okay? And, you know, that's basically, you know, the secret society we probably have the most, know the most about it is probably the mafia, okay? Yeah. And you know, they're running around with guns trying to kill people, right? Yeah. And you know, how do they operate? Well, they operate out of a, you know, commission, a council system. And you know, let's say you know, I look at these groups as I call them circles, okay? Yeah. And so you're going to have, you know, say a circle around some bankers, and you know, you're going to have another circle, and you know, they're, after some point in time, they're going to become aware of each other, right?
Yeah.
So how are they going to, you know, trust each other? Well, they say, maybe, well, how about some of you people come join my circle, and some of our people will join your circle, okay?
Yeah.
And then you'll have a situation that, you know, you might have a quote-unquote supreme council, okay?
Yeah.
That sets on top of that, okay? So you've got all kinds of, you know, I mean, how does the world operate, you know? And then the other thing that we need to throw in there is there are sovereign countries, okay?
Yeah.
And each sovereign country has its own quote-unquote rationale, right? And then, you know, let's look about how intelligence works, okay? I mean, and what is intelligence, okay? Well, intelligence is basically, first off, it's taking notes. Okay, yeah. That's what you do. You read everything. You know, you get everything that you can find in the public sphere. Okay, and you read it and you take notes and you cross reference it and blah 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 blah. Okay, and then if you can get the ability, okay, to look behind the wall and you know. Hear people's private conversations. Hear, you know, get private correspondence. Okay, and you have, you know, you have a personal private correspondence. You have, you know, corporate correspondence. You have government correspondence. You know, so you have these different things, and then, okay, once you take enough notes, okay, then you come to the position where you say, well, do I have enough information where I can go actionable?
Yeah.
Okay. And
actionable,
I can,
intelligence.
And I can make something happen. Okay. Mm. And I can do something for, you know, the benefit of my country or the benefit of quote unquote my corporations. Or then you have corporations that are running on their own beyond the strictures of government, right?
Of the nations, yeah, that, yeah.
Right, right. Yeah. So you know, once you get to the level of, you know, actionable people that are acting on the intelligence, okay, you had a certain amount of people on the playing field, okay, yeah. And then once when Trump was president and there was this big release of the CIA spy tools, okay, in 2017, yeah. Okay, that upped the capabilities of a bunch of different organizations, including criminal organizations,
yeah.
Okay, to be players on this actionable intelligence field,
yeah.
Okay, which then, you know, when you do actionable intelligence, and, you know, let's say we can call it a conspiracy, okay, well, now, you know, when you do a conspiracy, you don't jump up and down and say, hey, I'm doing this conspiracy, you want to join me?
Yeah.
No, what you do is you go out and you lie and you manipulate people, okay, into being beneficial to the conspiracy that you're trying to pull off.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've got a very, very wild and sophisticated world out there, I'll put it that way.
In terms of creating or precipitating sort of events and developments, you know, you only have to have a meeting of, you know, one or two people across any of these secret societies, and it is, you know, something that I've come to realize. You know, there are dozens and dozens of these secret societies that go back sort of, you know, hundreds of years, some cases, and they still, many of them have a prevailing influence on, you know, policy. And you only got to, you know, think about, you know, like, you know, the Bilderberg Corporation is just one off the top of my head that was started, you know, what, nearly 80 years ago, 70 or 80 years ago, that has a major impact on current policy. The World Economic Forum that was started back in 1971, that was over 50 years ago. And these are more recent, and the World Economic Forum is not so much a secret society,
right,
in that sense. They're much far more secret societies, but these are institutions and organizations which have, if not a secret agenda, they have an agenda that's quite at odds with the one that they would have us all believe. That's the problem I have with all of these secret societies and all of these different organizations.
And you know, there's quite some antiquity in these, like, you know, Skull and Bones itself goes to 1832, and we can show where it basically comes from, and, you know, they were directly involved in the drug trade at that time, okay, and while they were also making big money in the West, okay, I mean, do you think there's any secret societies in China or in the Orient in different places? You know, so and, you know, one thing that I've been saying for quite a while is that one thing that they've been looking to do is to, quote unquote, rule the world through China. Okay,
yeah.
Because you had you know. Oh, there's a great book out there called Gold Warriors by Sterling Seagrave that I strongly recommend.
I know that well. I had quite a lot of dealings with Sterling Seagrave up until the time that he died, and I've written about his work. And I'm glad you mentioned that, Chris. That was one of the most fascinating, revealing books that I've ever written. I've ever read. And
yeah.
I'm pleased you mentioned that. Yeah. So, Gold Warriors, yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's just one aspect of our history that people just were completely unaware of. And, you know, as I said, that sort of blew my mind when I read it. Chris, just before we go, I've only got a couple more minutes. I just want to, I want listeners to be aware of your show, The Journey. Tell us a little bit about The Journey. We've got a couple of minutes to go before the deadline.
Well,
what's The Journey all about?
Well, you know, just like, you know, myself, I was this, you know, day before my 20th birthday, my dad and this professor take me into a room and tell me this story, okay, and I don't understand it, okay, I mean, it's way beyond my ken, okay, and it takes me a long time just to, you know, to fathom it, okay, and we're all, you know, we go to school, we're given an education, and then we find out that, well, maybe the world's a little bit different than they were trying to tell me there, you know? And so we go on this journey, okay, to figure out how the world, quote unquote, really works, okay? And there's a lot of pitfalls and different things along the way, but I'm very lucky to know a bunch of these authors, and so I've been able to, you know, invite these authors on to tell their journey. And we just did one with Nick Bryant and Jim Norman and Daniel Hopsicker and this big researcher for Whitney Webb called The Ignored, because we all, you know, looked at these different things and we found, you know, but we're all just completely ignored, okay, because they can't even throw mud at us, because if they throw mud at us, you know, they'll have to talk about it.
Chris, we have to go. I really appreciate your time. I'll be posting a report on our interview with Chris Milligan from Trine Day Publishers.